Thank you, Tony. All right, so now I'd like to introduce our speaker. First off, I wanted to say that this year's speaker lineup so far has been incredible, and I got no doubt that it's only going to continue. I've heard Earl numerous times online. This is the first opportunity that I've had to meet him in person, and it truly has been an honor. Courtney had sent me a text the other day wanting to know how excited I was to be picking up one of my heroes from the airport to bring him to this event. And I never really thought of it that way until after listening to Johnny last night talk about, you know, heroes within our fellowship. And he certainly fits that description, and so do a lot of you people in this room for me. You guys are my hero. So Earl's been a very instrumental part in my sobriety. Without further introduction, here's my friend Earl.
Hi, everybody. My name's Earl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Earl. Hi. Is that a video camera, Jim? Sorry. My name's Bob. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Shreveport. My name's Earl. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come share here. It's always an honor and a privilege to do something like this. I want to thank the speakers that have already spoken. Thank you so much for carrying the message to me. And special shout-out to my Al-Anon sister, Winoy. See, I remembered your name. I went to the Al-Anon talk this afternoon, and man, get that tape. Get that tape. Man. What should we talk about? About that drinking thing, maybe. All right, so I didn't start drinking until I was 12. I waited as long as I possibly could. I had been restless, irritable, and discontented for quite some time prior to that. I grew up in let's just call it an unfriendly environment, all right, where I would wake up in the morning a little kid, and I was hungry, you know, and I'd stick my door out, my head out the door, you know, and there are two ways to get to the kitchen, to the cereal, right? You could go to the left and go that way, or you could go to the right and go that way, and I would go out, and I'd just try to feel it, you know, like, where is he? Where's my old man? Is he over there? Is he over there? You know, and then I'd make my move, you know, for the cereal. Sometimes it was a good move, sometimes it wasn't. But, you know, you do what you got to do. And not a friendly environment. I was walking on eggshells by the time I was 4 years old. When I was 12, I was an odd child. I started tripping before I started drinking. What I would do is, if you took your eyes, you lived up in these canyons, and if you took your eyes off me, I would just jet out into the backyard, and I'd hop over the back fence, and I'd go down into the deer runs, you know, and I'd pull off the deer run and just sit in the bushes and sit real still, and I'd wait around, and at dusk, you know, just before dusk, and at dusk, you know, the deer'd come down through the deer trails, and I'd just sit there, and I'd watch them all walk by, right, just still as I could be, till I'd hear him yelling my name, and I'd come up, you know, and hop back over the fence and get a whooping and, you know, have dinner and, you know, business as usual, right? And then I got a hold of some salt lick, and I got some salt lick, and then so the deer would come by, and I'd just stick my hand out with the salt in it, and the deer would lick the salt in my hand. And I was just catching a big buzz off of that, right? We knew by then it was already obvious what was going to happen, right? Then they ran a bunch of tests on me. They said, you know, this is a very strange child, right? So they went and did a bunch of tests on me, and it turned out I had a very high IQ. I don't have it anymore, so I'm not bragging. That's been gone for quite some time. One day my father walked into, there was this boarding school that was 9th through 12th grade, and they decided they were going to do what they called their great experiment, and it was going to be these five-year men. They were going to look for these eighth graders to come to be the first five-year men in this school that was originated in Bell Buckle, Tennessee, right? The Webb School for Boys, right? And they had one out on the West Coast. And so they sent out these exams all over the place, 5.5-hour exam, and I took it. And there were 16 kids that passed it, and I was one of them. And how I found out I was going to boarding school is my father walked in my room and said, "Get in the car." It's like, all right. I went outside and there were two cars. The engines were running. You know what I mean? A bunch of relatives in the cars. And I thought, what the heck? You know, and I got in the car and he got in the car. And we drove and drove and drove and drove and drove and drove. We got to this place by this mountain. We pulled up. He got out of the car. I got out of the car. Nobody else got out of the car. He walked over to me, put a suitcase down next to me. Stuck out his hand. He said, "This will make a man out of you." Got back in the car and everybody took off. And I remember standing there. I mean, I was like 5 feet tall, 104 pounds. You know, manhood was right around the corner. You know, and the feeling was I'd just been thrown away by the people who knew me best in the world, and I didn't know what I'd done to get tossed out like that. The fact was I was being given an opportunity for a wonderful education, held me in good stead to this very day. All right? But I'm not a facts guy. You know? You know, if it feels bad, it is bad. That's, you know what I mean? And that felt real bad. So, and I called home for like 3 or 4 days every night, you know, crying, telling my mother, look, just come get me, bring me home. We won't need to, no need to discuss it. You know what I mean? We'll just act like it didn't happen. We'll just, you know, we'll call that kind of like a parental mulligan, right? You know, and we'll just move on from there, right? And in the background, you hear my father going, "Hang up." And I'm like, "Gotta go." Click, right? And in that first week, I was walking around trying not to make eye contact with anybody, and I met Tiny. Actually, Tiny found me. I didn't find him. Tiny, every high school's got a guy named Tiny. He's like 6'4", 240, plays guard on the football team, you know. And Tiny came up to me, and he said, "How you doing, punk?" And he slapped me in the back of the head and sent me and my books flying. And I had this, like, out-of-body experience, you know, where you're watching yourself do something, you know, while your head, you're saying, you know, "This is a very bad idea. Probably shouldn't be doing this." And I walked up to Tiny and I hit him as hard as I possibly could, which had no effect on Tiny whatsoever. And he looked down at me and said, "You got a lot of guts, kid." And then he beat the crap out of me, right? And as I'm taking the beating, I'm thinking, you know, this is going pretty good. Right? Because I was terrified of Tiny. Right? But he had just said, "You got a lot of guts." My violence had masked my fear, right? So, I mean, he beat me. I mean, but I'm one of those guys that, you know, you knock me down, I just get back up. You know, you knock me down, I get back up. You know, guys are standing around going, "Just, you know, stay down, stay down." Couldn't do it. So I took my whooping, and I'm on my way back to my dorm room waiting for the bleeding to stop. I got knots on my head, man. I mean, I'm messed up. And I'm thinking, man, my life sucks. I mean, just a few days ago, everything was fine, you know? And now it's like, you know, family's throwing me away. Giant people are beating me. You know, I'm just not thrilled at all. There's 249 teenagers in this school and one 12-year-old. I don't belong here. I don't fit in. I'm the youngest and smallest. It's like Lord of the Flies in this place, man. I got to get out of here, right? And word spread across this campus like wildfire. Watch out for this little Hightower kid. He's a maniac. He attacked Tiny, right? Now I got this reputation that has absolutely nothing to do with who I really am. I mean, I'm just a frightened child, right? But I got this, and I'm a maniac, right? So the cool guys started coming around. And Matt stuck his head in my dorm room. And he stuck his head and he went, "Hey, man, you want to smoke a joint?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And I had no idea what he was talking about. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't care. All I heard was, "Do you want to come with us?" They could have said, "Look, we're going to kill the Spanish teacher. You want to come?" I would have said, "I'm in. Let's go." They got me in Latin. "I'll go kill the Spanish teacher." And we stopped and we picked up Steve. And Steve had a Tupperware container full of cheap red wine. And I'm talking cheap, no grapes involved red wine. You know what I mean? The fortified stuff, right? And he had, right, so we had a Tupperware container, two 13-year-olds and a 12-year-old babies, right? We went behind the dorm. We're standing by this big tree. I can see it like it was yesterday, man. And he let the joint, took a hit, and he handed it to me. I took a hit, and it burned my lungs. I was like, "Ugh. Here." that wine thing, right? Took a pull on that wine, and that vapor thing happened. You know what I mean? Where it just goes and hits the bottom of your stomach, and there's that vapor action comes back up, and I was just like, oh, right? Give me that joint thing back again there. Right? Nope, still don't like that. Give me that wine back. You know what I mean? it happened. That thing that makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows occurred. And suddenly I was comfortable standing where I was standing, doing what I was doing with the people I was doing it with, and I'd never felt like that before in my life. Right? And I don't know. Is it the pot? Is it the wine? Is it the fact that I'm standing here with my two very close personal friends, Matt and Steve? I don't care. You know? Like, all the problems went away. I'm not afraid of Tiny anymore. I don't care where he is. You know? Parents don't want me. I don't want them. Turned my back on my family and pretty much never went back. Right? You know, I had my new buds, and I woke up the next morning, and what I got to remember is that in the beginning, it worked perfectly for me. It worked perfectly. It did exactly what I wanted it to do. It was anti-oral medication. You know, it just took me out of the equation, right? And I was comfortable in my own skin, you know, my own heartbeat, just breathing my own breath. You know, I was just right in there. I was okay, you know? And I woke up that next morning, and this, you don't have to go. Unless you don't like this, I mean, you can go if you don't, you know. If I'm pissing you off, you can go, but, you know. But you don't have, that's just a baby. You know, one of you is an alcoholic, knows where their baby is. So, I mean, you know, this is fantastic, both of you. That's a double winner. I love it. That's like a baby seat in AA, right? Like carriage thing. All right. You speak up anytime you want, kid. We're all right. So anyway, what the hell was I talking about? Right. Right. So the humble beginnings, you know, a little pot, a little wine, no big deal. I talk about drugs in my story. I'm a child of the 60s, but you got to understand, the only thing that was on the table at all times for me was alcohol. Because drugs are completely unreliable. There is no quality control going on out there. You don't know what you got till you get it in your body. You get yourself a fifth of Jack Daniels, you get yourself a good quart of gin, you know what you got. Right? You're going to be all right. No matter what the drugs do or don't do, you got your booze right here, you're going to be okay. Right? You do so much cocaine, you can't get your mouth open anymore. You know? You know, you suck a little Jack Daniels through your teeth, it'll loosen you right up, and you can go on with the party. You're all right. Jack is there for you, right? Acid a little too spooky, don't worry about it. You know, you drink enough gin, it'll get you right back in the comfort zone. You'll be all right. Booze is reliable. Drugs are not reliable. Didn't stop me from taking a, you know, aircraft carrier full of them, but, you know. So anyway, a little pot and wine is the beginnings. 13 was pills. The only reason I took a pill is the guy said, would you like a couple of pills? And I just took them and swallowed them and said, what were those? Which is the alcoholic way. The normal person says, what are they? Gets an answer. They make a decision. And then maybe they take them, maybe they don't. I just take them and then inquire what's about to happen. You know? Which way are we going? You know? Am I heading for the floor or are we driving to Seattle? Which is it? I don't know. I don't really care. Right? 14 was psychedelics. The only reason I did any psychedelics was because I was on a 10-hour pass with a girl named Debbie, and Debbie was a very bad girl. And I will love her till the day I die. Tremendous respect for Debbie. And Debbie said, would you like to drop some acid? And I said, yes, I would. And she took out a lipstick tube, and she took the top off and spun it up, and there was a little pill on the end of it, which I thought was extremely clever. And I took it off, popped it in my mouth, swallowed it. And Debbie said, did you take that whole thing? And I said, well, yes, I did. It was very tiny. And she said, that's three hits of white lightning. Oh, over here. I love always love it. Always, there's a few people that just go, oh. That's not good. No, it was not. Next 2 or 3 days were very interesting. And about 600 hits later, I got classified legally insane by the military, but that's a whole other story we don't have time for. 15, I started shooting dope. The only reason I shot dope was I was on a boat in Marina Del Rey, California, with a girl named Cammie. Lovely girl. Cammy said, would you like me to stick this in your body? And I said, I'm certain of it. Yeah. And she did, and it was one of those shots where you just go, and on the way down, all I remember thinking was, if I'm not dead, I'm doing that again. Because that was instant what problems. I don't remember being worried about anything ever in my life. So as a humble, you know what I mean? It was just the progression was, you know, on its way, man. It was marching along at a pretty fast clip. By the time I was 16, I decided I'd had enough of higher education. So I dropped out of high school. My father came back in my life, said, you've gone nuts. Threw me in my first mental institution for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation. I thought that was a little excessive. So, you know, I talked my way out of that joint, went back on the street, doing what we just say, loaded, right? They threw the net over me again, dragged me back in the nut house. And I had learned, you gotta get out before they get the Thorazine in you. Cause if you get the Thorazine in you, you're leaving when they say, you know? You got two speeds, slow and stopped. That's it, right? So I was in the intake interview and, you know, I knew I got a bolt, man. I gotta hit. So I was like, hey, look at that. You know what I mean? I was out the door, man. The bells are going off and the whistles, and I'm out in the backyard running as fast as I can. There's a guy on my tail, man. And I hit that back fence, and I was over that back fence and gone. So the next 3 years doing what we do just to stay out there, doing our thing, right? And I was out there doing my thing, progressing, 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 right? By the time I'm 19, I get accepted to business college. Long story. But I end up in Northern California in business college, and I become a drug dealer. Right? Made perfect sense to me. Right? Do what you know. And, I mean, I had no morals. I had no ethics. I had no sense of family. I had no sense of community. I was just loose. You know, I was just out there doing what I could do. Right? And I'm studying marketing, production, distribution. I'm applying it to my business. You know, business is booming. I think college is amazing. Right? And they had a health fair. So I go to this health fair. And, you know, they're doing checkups on people, and they go, we run a few more tests on you. And I was like, all right, you know, felt kind of special, right? They ran them on me and said, well, you have malignant cancer. And I was like, great, of course I do. So I flew back to L.A. They had prepared me for major surgery. They did major surgery. They did it on my upper back. Took about a pound out of my upper back and told me that I needed to get my affairs in order because it was late stage. And that was the first time it really struck me what my life had come to, because here I was, 19, 20 years old, I'm being told to get my affairs in order, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I make a couple of phone calls, you know, we're pretty much good to go here. You know, I got nothing going on. I have, you know, I haven't done anything. I got nothing to show for my life at all. I'm not heading anywhere. I'm not moving towards something. I haven't accomplished anything. I'm just loose, man. I'm just on the loose. And so I do the cancer thing. They put me in nuclear medicine, they called it back then, chemotherapy now. And I did that for a little bit, and I wasn't getting a good buzz off of that stuff, right? So I left and went home and got loaded the way I get loaded, and I'm a long-term cancer survivor. And about a year later, I'm 21 years old, my mother calls me and she says, we haven't been anywhere as a family in almost 10 years. You know, your 22nd birthday is coming up. We'll go anywhere you want to go, but we're going as a family. We're putting this family back together. And I remember thinking, well, you know, and she starts crying, and I'm thinking, you know, that's not fair. You know what I mean? A son has no defense against a weeping mother, right? So I said, fine. So I flew back to L.A., and on my 22nd birthday, we took off the flight to Guadalajara, and on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, my little sister all died in the crash, and I didn't. And I remember waking up in the wreckage, and my mother was laying over there, my little sister Kimberly was right over there, and my father was over there, and I had broken my skull, my back in three places, my arm, my leg. I had a lot of internal injuries. I was paralyzed from the waist down. Only thing I could move was my right arm, and I couldn't get it to any of them to help them. So I laid there, and I watched them all bleed to death, and it was like a quiet moment, man. It wasn't like this big, you know, shaking your fist at God, you know, rage and scream and yell and thing. It was just this quiet, you could hear a pin drop up there, man. And it was like flipping a switch, man. I just flipped the switch. No, I just said, you know what? I have no interest in a God that would take a kind, gentle, poetic creature like my little sister Kimberly and leave me a lying, cheating, thieving, dope fiend like me on this planet. I got no, you know, alcoholic like me on this planet. I got no use for a God of this type, and I renounce God. And then some guys came up, and they scavenged the plane wreck, took what they could find of value, and left me there to die. So I had no more love for you either. I was out of the game, man. And then some other guys came up, and they threw me in the back of a truck with my mother, and they took us down to an aid station, and I was the only one left alive, and I didn't die, so eventually they took us to a hospital. And I got my ID out, and they found out my name. And that brought the federales, right? A little issue with the Mexican government. They were not happy to see me back in their country. So they interrogated me through an interpreter for 3.5 days, wanting to know what I was doing back in Mexico. And it was unpleasant, to say the least. And I finally got a hold of a phone, and I called a guy in Northern California, and they flew in a plane, and they plastered me from the neck down, and threw me on a plane and got me out of Mexico and ended up in a hospital in Southern California. And I was getting maximum shots of Demerol every 3 hours around the clock because I had a good story to sell, you know. And that's what a good, you know, alcoholic, drug addict does, you know what I mean? You sell your story, right? And those nurses were eating it up like a spoon, man. That poor boy, all that he has been through, you know, load him up. Just load him up, right? So by the time I got out of there, I was wearing I had a custom back brace I'd had made, and my leg was still in a cast, and I had a cane and this brace on, and I had hair down, you know, here, and I was just crazy, man. I'd lost a lot of weight while I was in the hospital, and I was strung out like a lunatic. And I came out of there knowing I had 3 hours to connect, you know, before I started kicking like a dog. And I went on my last run, and it lasted for 6 years. And during that 6 years, I got sober 3 or 4 times. But not to get sober, I detoxed 3 or 4 times. There's a difference, right? You know, getting sober is not the same as running out, you know? There is a significant difference between the two. And I used to go to this bootleg sanitarium in Hollywood, California, this bootleg detox, right? You had to know the guy who knew the guy where it was, right? And you'd go in, and there was like a nurse, you know, and you'd give her $150 cash, and you'd give her, you know, your wallet and your car keys and your gun and your Valium, you know, whatever all you had on you. You know, you just slide it all across the counter, and they take you in and strap you to a gurney, shoot you full of anticonvulsants, and let you ride. And after about 72 hours, they'd unstrap you, and you'd sit up. Now, in 72 hours, my kick's just getting going, you know what I mean? I'm still climbing, you know what I mean? I haven't peaked yet. You know, the pain is still coming, right? And they'd sit me up, and I remember like the 3rd or 4th time I was in there, the nurse said, "Now, Earl, if I had a buck for every time I'd heard it said like that, Earl. Son, you know that for you to drink uses, it's complete lunacy, don't you? You know you're an alcoholic, don't you? Yes, ma'am. I mean, no hesitation. I knew what I was. Yes, that's very true." She goes, "You know, for you to drink or use is madness. It's just madness." I go, "How come? I got no comeback for that either. You're out. You're right." She goes, "So now, armed with this information, you're going to be a good boy. You're not going to drink or use no matter what, are you?" I said, "No. Not an idiot." And I'd go back, you know, I'd get on and off the gurney, you know, and it, you know, still I'm just shaking like a leaf, you know what I mean? Go back up, and they'd give me all my stuff back, you know, stick it in all my pockets. I'd be walking out to my car, and I'd be shaking, and I'd be thinking, "I don't think I should drive like this, you know. If I'm not mistaken, Valium is medically indicated here." So I took what I considered to be a moderate dose of Valium, about 40 milligrams, right? Smoothed me right out. And, you know, 4 days later, I came to in Oakland. And I don't know anybody in Oakland. You know, I just, boom, you know, that was my thing, 4-day blackouts. I'd be sitting doing something, I'd blink, and it would be 4 days later, and I'd be talking to a completely different set of people. If I was lucky. Right. I don't know why that is. But anyway, you know, I just kept moving closer to death. Now, I'm not a suicidal person. I've never been suicidal. That's never been my thing. I don't know why. It's just not been my thing to kill myself. I will say this, however. My drinking got to the place where death was an acceptable consequence of the way I was behaving. You know, if it killed me, it killed me. I didn't care. So my grasp of life was, I was hanging on by a thread, you know, and it went like that for 6 years. And I mean, I got all the war stories and the madness and the insanity, you know, that people like us get along the way. I mean, it just was horrible. You know, there were no relationships of any consequence or substance. I was completely alone in the world. The violence was insane. You know, I came out of my last blackout. It was the day before my 28th birthday, and I was 215 pounds. I had hair down to almost to my waist. I was yellow. My heart was swollen. The sac around my heart. They were deciding whether or not to charge me with the attempted murder of David Luboff. Police were outside. I'd broken 74 bones. Both my hands were broken at the time. I had over 650 stitches in me. I'd been stabbed twice, shot at. The violence in my life had been completely nuts. And I'm the most mellow, peaceful guy you'll ever meet, sober. But, you know, it's that old Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story, you know. And family was dead. Had no family, had no place to live, no friends. I mean, I was just flatlined. My life was just a wasteland. And I had what they call in here a moment of clarity. And I got to tell you, all that stuff I just told you had no effect on me whatsoever. I didn't care about any of that stuff. That wasn't going to stop me. Now, I had gotten to the point in my drinking and using where drugs were so secondary to me. And a child of the 60s, I mean, we were focused on the drugs. Our parents were the alcoholics. We weren't going to kill ourselves like them. We were going to find a whole new way to kill ourselves, right? Trying to carve out this new identity. But that had gone by the wayside, man. My thing was drinking. That's what I was, you know, I was knocking it down at a ridiculous rate on a daily basis. And I remember I was just so brutally hungover and messed up. And I'm sitting there and I had this moment of clarity. And it's none of that outside stuff. What it was for me was I hit a spiritual bottom, and it was that I wasn't connected to another human being on the face of the earth. And that was the direct result of my alcoholism. And if I didn't want to die like that, I was going to have to find consciousness beyond that which I currently possessed. My best thinking was killing me, you know? And I raised up two busted hands and I said, help. And there was somebody there that knew about all this, right? And knew that I had to reach out before it was going to be worth anything. And I said, help. And they grabbed me and they threw me. There was a police car and an ambulance there. And they grabbed me and threw me in the back of the ambulance. And I was gone before the cops knew what had happened, right? And they took me to UCLA emergency. And they pumped my stomach. And they said, get him out of here. He's going to die. And they took me to Olive View Medical Center. And they kept me there for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days. I'm not really sure. But I do remember, you know, they checked me in. They put me in this room. And I had a roommate. And it was this guy. And he was long and lean. He was about 6'4", and he was leaning. He was on his bunk, and he was facing the wall. He was leaned up against the wall, and he had long, black, greasy hair. I mean, this guy was nasty, man. And he had those nail beds, you know, the fingernails that were the liver checked out a year ago, and nobody told him. You know what I mean? I mean, this guy was in bad shape, and he was an old junkie, is what he was. I mean, that's like finding a unicorn. You know what I mean? An old one of those. And he rolls over and he sits up on the bunk and he looks at me, and I'm just sitting there shaking and I'm so sick, man. And he looks at me and he goes, dude, you look bad. I'm just thinking, oh my God, man. He thinks I look bad. Great. And I just kept getting sicker, and then the ambulance showed up and they threw me in that ambulance. They took me down to a place called Long Beach General Hospital. And they took me to this room, and it was, the detox was like guys right off the street, right? And it was 42 cots in one room, army cots, 21 cots on each side of the room with sheets drawn between the cots. And how you kicked was called riding the cot. There were no meds. Nobody showing up at night going, you know, are you a little anxious tonight, Earl? Can I get you a little something to help you sleep? You know, like, no, it was just, hang on, buddy. You know, we know, odds on you were about dead even right now. You know what I mean? You just hung on. And I made the commitment. I'm going to live or die in this cot. And I stayed there for 47 days. And at the end of 47 days, I got up out of that cot. And Ray W., God bless him, said to me, Earl, you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, if you don't want to die, you better go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only place a guy like you has a shot. And I remember after everything that I had been through, after the mayhem of my life, not one good thing had happened in several years. Just hopelessness, right? When he said, you know, you go to AA or die, I remember looking at him and thinking, really? It's come to this, has it? I got to go to the A&A, huh? Oh, man. Okay. I don't think it's going to go well. I was pretty sure that A&A thing wasn't gonna work, you know. Not for a guy like me, you know. Because I'm different, you see. So I ended up in the basement of a church on a Friday night. It's out of my mind, right? Now, the physical phenomenon of craving had been dealt with for the most part. But the obsession of the mind, the greater aspect of my disease, my alcoholism, was in full effect, man. And I was as crazy as you can be without somebody throwing a net over you. And I walked in the back of that room, and I sat down in the back row, you know, my eyes darting around in my head, mad dogging everybody, you know, don't come up on me. Uh-uh. Check where the doors and windows are, scan the room, see it, you know, read, you know, you live like I lived, you know how to read a room. You find out who's got the juice in here, where's the power, you know, vibe it out, find out who the guys are that are running this deal, slide up on them, burglarize that conversation, find out what they got, get back in your chair. I'm not joining, I'm on a tactical mission. I'm here to gather intel, all right, and then I'm out. I looked up and they had those scrolls up and I said, the traditions, and I said, for the group, I'm not a group, don't need those. Steps. I read them and I got, okay, I got that. What else you got? Right? I thought, I understood it. That's all you need, right? It's understand them. Right? I sat in the back of the room and some people got up and they read and talked about things, you know, but, you know, my brain was bouncing around in my skull. I couldn't track any of that, right? And then this guy got up and he shared his experience, strength, and hope. Now, I didn't know that's what he was sharing, but he told a story. He told a story about how he used to drink. And I thought, I drank? Yeah, I drank like that. And then he talked about that something had happened, that it changed it up for him. And I thought, yeah, me too. And then he talked about what his life was like today. And I thought, well, you lost me there. Because I got none of that. You know? But I left. And without being able to verbalize it, you know, or put my finger on it, but the feeling, something changed inside me. There was like a pilot light that went on. And what it was that guy gave me hope. I came there hopeless. And that first guy that shared gave me hope that possibly a guy like me didn't have to die drunk. And I thought, I'm going to come back and hear that man speak again. Because I knew so little about this, I thought, that's the meeting where that guy talked. That was where he talked. If you wanted to hear him talk, you went that meeting on Friday night, right? So the next Friday, I went there to hear that guy talk. And I sat and I waited, you know, the blah, 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 blah that they do in the beginning. You know what I mean? I'm not paying any attention to it all. How it works. Yeah, right. Good luck with that, right? And, you know, and then doing all this stuff. And then they said, and our speaker tonight's Betty. And I went, time out. Where's Bob? The guy next to me goes, you're new, aren't you? It's like, what's your point, pal? And he said, no, take it easy. We have a different speaker every week. I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, we got all different kinds of meetings. We got men's tags, women's tags, speaker meetings, discussion meetings, blah, blah, blah. And I felt like my head was going to blow off my shoulders, right? I was, you know, I had like, get car, go meeting, here, Bob, go home. That's it. That's what I could do. I was not a well man. And now he's telling me, that's not what's going to happen. And all the while this is going on, the 75-year-old woman, Betty's making her way to the podium. She's moving, man. She's going for the podium, right? And she's got the little spring dress on, little hair helmet, you know what I mean? She's moving. She gets at the podium. I'm like, oh, my God, right? How am I getting this hour of my life back? Yeah. This can't be happening to me. Seriously? And she gets up and says, my name's Betty. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Betty. And Betty starts talking, and all of a sudden, Betty explains that in her day, if you were a reasonably good-looking woman, and had 50 cents, you could walk into a bar and drink for 2 weeks and explain how you go about doing that. By the time Betty sat down, I looked at the guy next to me and I said, Betty is a badass. I would roll with Betty. Now, I left that meeting, man. I'm like completely sprung now. I go, I'm identifying with a 75-year-old woman. What the hell is going on? I don't understand what's happening, right? And I just thought, well, I got to fan out in this deal. You know what I mean? Because obviously, you know, I don't know where the hell Bob is. So, you know, I'll just... So next thing you know, I'm in a meeting today and I got this going on and that going on. They said, you know what I mean? You need commitments. I'm like, great, you know, commitments. That sounds fantastic, right? So you come in and they said, you got to get a sponsor. And I said, what's a sponsor? And they said, well, a sponsor is somebody who's got what you want. And I said, well, I would like to drink. So maybe that's not a good idea just yet to be throwing the ball back in my court. And I've come to believe that you should get a sponsor who's got what he wants, you know, because that's a good definition of happiness. A happy man is a man who's got what he wants, right? And that's what I found. I was at a meeting one day, and this guy came into the meeting. And, I mean, he didn't just come into a meeting. He just flew into a meeting. He flew in. I mean, you know, my first sponsor, the late, great Donald Madden, who saved my life, was a very flamboyant gay man. And when he came into the meeting, he was the kind of guy that he walked into a room and everybody turned and went, who's the big gay guy? I mean, he didn't have to say anything, make a move, nothing, man. He was just a very, very gay man. And he flew up to the podium and he said, my name is Donald Madden and I'm an alcoholic. And everybody went, hi, Donald. And you could tell, I'm like, God, everybody in here loves this guy, right? And he broke it down, man. I mean, this guy got up there and he had a passion for recovery and a passion for life. And he didn't care what anybody thought, man. This guy was bold. And there was a courage and a right here, right now about him that was just amazing. And I remember he sat down, I said, that's him. I almost asked that guy to sponsor me. And these dudes I was sitting with, they're like, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I don't feel strongly about anything. I'm dead inside, man. And that guy has a passion for life. And I want that fire. I want that fire that man has. So I'm going to ask him to sponsor me. And I did. And I called him every day and I did everything that man told me to do for almost 14 years up until the day he died. And he saved my life. He was Alcoholics Anonymous to me. I made him one promise and I've kept it to this very day. And that's been, he passed, almost 20 years ago. Almost 20 years ago. This was 19 years this last July. And this coming July will be 20 years. And anyway, I started doing all the things that you're told to do in here. You know, they said get commitments. I got them. They said clean up. I cleaned up. I wasn't good at interacting with other humans. All right, that was my weak spot. Right. So they thought they'd be clever. So they made me the greeter at, you know, the Saturday night meeting. I was the greeter for 1 week. Because people were going up to the secretary and going, I got to tell you, I don't feel welcome. Because I was just like, yeah, how are you? Get in there. Yeah, great to see you too, buddy. Go on. Get in there. No, we will not be hugging. Get in. So they gave me the cleanup committee. So we'd wait. I'd wait till everybody was gone, then I would mop up the joint and turn out the lights and close the place up and lock it up, right? And that was it. And I remember one day being this kind of sponsor I had. I was so crazy, man. My commitment started at about 10:20, an 8:30 to 10 p.m. meeting on this Saturday night, this one particular meeting. And I was so crazy, man. I was coming undone. And I was heading for the meeting, and it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm 6 o'clock at night, and I'm driving towards the meeting, and it starts at 8:30, because I know that the setup crew and all those guys and you know Don and everybody are showing up at 6 to get the coffee going and to get everything set up and have the meeting before the meeting and all that stuff that I wasn't a part of, and I just said I'm gonna go, and the first guy that says what are you doing here, I'm gonna do everything I can to kill him. That's just what's going to happen. And I was insane. And I went marching in the back of this of Ohio Street, through the kitchen. I walked through the back door, and fist clenched, ready to rock. Right? And I go walking through the door, and he saw me. And he raced up to the podium, and through the microphone, before anybody could say anything to me, this is what I heard. Earl, it's 6:22, and you're late. And I just looked up at him. Still makes me cry. And of course, you have no Kleenex for me up here. Give me those things. I'm going to need more than that. Talking about Donald. Okay. What he did was he saw me, and he let everybody in that. He saw the boy's crazy. I got to do something. So he made it safe for me to be there. He let everybody in that room know that I was supposed to be there, that he had required me to be there, and that I was late, and just to let me come. And everybody's like, oh, he's supposed to be here. So, you know, all that we were about to say to him, I guess we're not going to be saying that, right? And I just looked at him like, how do you know? I hide it so well. How do you know how broken I am? How do you know how shattered I am as a human being? How do you know that I have anxiety attacks driving to meetings and I have to pull the car over and sit in the car huddled up in a ball waiting for it to pass before I can get up and drive the rest of the way to a meeting, right? I'm loading up now. He just knew, you know what I mean? What I've come to understand is, you know, that there was nothing special about me. I was just a destroyed alcoholic. That's all I was. And that he'd been like me. And there were countless men in those meetings who were just like me. They were just further down the road. They'd become comfortable sober, and they were going to be that example to me. And they weren't going to throw me away. You know, we don't kill our wounded here, right? We don't shoot the wounded. We embrace them, right? I remember when I read him my fourth step. I did my fifth step with him, right? And I told him the truth. And I remember that we were on our way to a meeting. We were driving in a car, and he had to pull the car over 3 or 4 times on the way to the meeting because I thought I was going to be sick, telling him all this stuff, right? And I remember we stopped on the way to get a burger at this place, and it was this little hamburger stand where they had the outside tables, you know, that are cement, you know what I mean? And right, and the chairs are bolted to the ground, you know, right, to the cement. And we were saying, you know, when you're nervous, your voice gets a little louder, you know, when you're nervous. So I'm, you know, reading, you know what I mean? I'm reading my inventory at the burger joint to him, and there's like people that are sitting at these other tables. People are getting up and just quietly moving away. You know, so there's this like this ring of empty tables around us as I'm just going out. And then I was going to kill him, but I didn't, you know, and then it, we're, you know, and I'll never forget. I finished and I looked up at him and I was so exhausted, man, emotionally exhausted from that. And I looked at him and he just smiled at me and he said, baby, we don't kill people here one day at a time. That was the first direction I got. And I said, I can do that. Okay. Well, we don't do that. I got to admit, I'm a little relieved. All right. I think I'm a guy that could do it. I don't know how well I could live with it. Right. And so my journey with Donald began. And I started to get, and then I found out something quite remarkable. And if you're new, I want to welcome you, and I want you to know that there's this circle with a triangle. It's an ancient spiritual symbol. It stands for mind, body, and spirit, brought together as a whole human being. And therein lies the balance I'd sought my whole life, and I'd never been able to find drunk or sober. And Alcoholics Anonymous adopted that symbol, and it stands for unity, service, and recovery. Same thing. The unity is the body. I bring it here. I can't stay sober, but we seem to be able to. What's the first word in the steps? We. Right? Together. Right? Thank you. Testify, brother. We'll get this thing going. Right? So unity is the body. I bring it here. Recoveries of the mind. I got to work the 12 steps. Because without working those 12 steps, I'm never going to catch the buzz that's available here. I'm never going to get the freedom that I truly seek, to be free of the disease of alcoholism. Get that beast off my back, whispering in my ear all the time, whispering in my ear all the time. Stone cold sober, cleaning up Ohio Street on a Saturday night, 2.5 years sober. Beast says, "How you doing, Earl?" "Huh?" "Earl, you seem very, very stressed out. Very stressed out. And I want you to know I'm here for you. I love you. I've always been here for you. And if I'm not mistaken, stress is a medical issue. It's a medical issue. And I'm concerned about you." And "Earl, have you heard of the Lowe's Hotel? It's right on the water. It's lovely. And in the Lowe's Hotel, right by the ocean, you can hear the waves, the water, the natural rhythm of the waves. Very soothing, comforting. And in the Lowe's Hotel, they have a jazz lounge." Now, these two words are lovely on their own. You put them together. Jazz lounge. This is a remarkable place within a remarkable place. And you know what they have there, Earl? Have you seen it? It's called an apple martini. An apple martini. If I'm not mistaken, apple is a fruit. Quite nutritious. And it's legal. Completely legal. You just go down there and, you know, don't worry. We don't have to tell. I know that you're very serious about this ANA thing, you know, but we don't need to tell them. It will just be our little secret. We'll just go down to Lowe's Hotel. We'll sit down. A lady will walk up just in the light of day. And we'll say, "Can I get you anything?" And you say, "You know what? I think I would like just one. Only one. Apple martini." And they will say, "Lovely choice." And they will go and get you an apple martini. And they'll bring it back, you know, and I'm certain it's very refreshing. Here's what I know about that. Now, I'm sitting in the back of I'm 2.5 years sober, haven't worked the steps yet, mopping up a meeting, right? Because they're waiting for me to get well, because I was so sick when I got here and crazy. They're waiting for me to stabilize at 2.5 years so we can start working some steps. I'm just a mess, right? And I know, stand there, I know. If I have one apple martini, two things are going to happen. Everybody goes, "Well, what's one drink going to do?" I'll tell you. It'll do two things every time. One is I drink, I'm out. I know that I've just separated myself from Alcoholics Anonymous. I take a drink. You know, no matter where I go to AA, everywhere I go, they're all very, very serious about the no drinking thing. I've always thought this would be a much bigger outfit if they just kind of get a little bit more relaxed about that. But very serious about the no drinking thing. So that's going to happen. I'm carved out of the herd with one drink. Two, it's going to shift my consciousness just enough for me to say these few simple words. "Well, that went well. You know what's next, right? I'll have another." Right? Because if one went well, two's going to go very well. Right? 6 hours later, I'm on my way down to downtown Los Angeles, right? And nothing good has ever come of me heading for downtown LA. Nothing. Ever. Right? So that's what one drink will do, those two things every time, right? I'm in the back of a meeting, and I'm listening to this beast in my head, and I'm thinking, I got to get rid of this. I got to get this thinking. This thinking is going to kill me. I can't fight that off with one hand and try to live life with the other. It was suggested to me that I look in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, "You know, I think I have one of those." So we started to go through the book, and it was fascinating, right? Me and this friend of mine, Christopher, went to sit down. We got the Joe and Charlie tapes, and we popped those tapes in. Big book comes alive. Opened up our book, and we started going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the big book. We read the doctor's opinion in the first 164 pages, third edition. We're third edition guys, right? So we're going through this, and it was hysterical. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times we'd be reading along and I'd look up at Christopher and I'd go, "Hey, you know that thing they say all the time? Here it is, right here." This is where they've been getting all that stuff. Right here. 15 minutes would go by, he'd look up and he'd go, "I'll be damned, look at this thing right here. That's that thing they say. Right there." One run after another. And what we do, the step's pretty simple. Step one is, what's the problem? Lack of power is my dilemma. I may be very, very capable in other areas of my life, but when it comes to drinking, I'm nuts. Right? Step two is, Could I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, soundness of mind, relieve me of the obsession of drink? Well, it's going to have to be something bigger than me because I've tried everything I know and I just keep getting drunk. I can't stop it. I can't stop it. So yes, I believe that that's what it's going to take. So I have a problem. I have a solution to the problem. Step three tells me, well, you better do something about it. What should I do? Get down on your knees and turn your will and your life over to the care of a God you may or may not understand. So I get down on my knees and I turn my will and my life over to the care of a God I did not understand. I had evidence of that God that I saw on a daily basis, but I didn't profess to understand God. That's just me. Right? And then it started to get, I thought that was deep, man, 1, 2, and 3, but it got real deep in 6 through 9. Because 4 and 5 was me, 6 and 7 was you, 8 and 9 was God, or 6 and 7 was God, 8 and 9 was you, and that was the whole team. There's nobody else to play with. That was everybody. Everybody contained in 6 steps. 4 and 5, I swallowed large chunks of truth about myself before God to another human being. 6 and 7, I hooked it up with God and asked God to remove the defects of character because I'll remove the wrong stuff. I cut deals. I don't surrender. You know, so we had to try it a different way this time, right? Let it go, right? 8 and 9, when you think about it, 8 and 9 is really the first time they let you out of the house, right? You sit on the couch and go, step one, yep, got to be that. Step two, Step three, down on the knees, here you go, back up on the couch. Write the 4-step, invite the sponsor in, here's step 5, he goes, good luck with all that, he leaves the house, right? 6, God, help. 7, seriously, help. Eight, a list. 9, now notice 6 and 7, there's a couple sentences in the book. That's it, right? Now, there's a lot that's explained in 12 and 12, which is vital, in my opinion. But they're just couple of sentences, because they don't want you to get stuck there, because they know us, we read ahead. Nobody wants to go anywhere near 9, so, you know, you can hang out in 6 or 7 for 6, you know, how long, you working on humbly, Earl? Yes, humbly, I'm working on the humbly. I'm going to humbly ask, you know, how long have you been doing that? About 8 years now. Humbly, I don't want to go anywhere near that stuff up ahead, right? Because I got to make a list, and I got to go in 9, I got to go out in the world. And there's a lot of conversation in the book about how you go about that, which essentially is, I'm very, very sorry, here's your money, back in the house. Right? And constantly my sponsor had to remind me, Earl, they do not want your money. They want their money. Right. I don't know why I keep forgetting that. 10, 11, and 12 keep me in the game. 10 me, 11 God, 12 you. 10, I continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it, because in that first pass through the steps, I just scratch the surface. That's the beauty of this thing, man. This will go as deep as you want to go. How big a buzz you want? Big one? Come on. Do the work. You know, chop the wood and carry the water of AA. That's all you got to do, man. And the well is as deep as you can take it. Nobody's ever hit the bottom and go, well, there's nothing else to do here. And not true. Not true. 11, I seek God. How? Through prayer and meditation. What do I pray for? Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. Why do I meditate? To quiet the mind so that when the answers come, I can hear them. After Donald died, I got a sponsor. Within 3 hours, I had another sponsor. A good friend of his. I needed a guy who sat at the same table. Right, and I went, and Al S. became my sponsor. And I said, Al, what do you want me to do? And he goes, well, you do everything I would ever ask of anybody. I think that you should learn to meditate. I think it would change your life. And I said, okay, where? And he said, take down this phone number and call that guy. And I said, okay. I called up my friend Christopher, and I said, well, we have to learn to meditate. And he goes, why? How'd I get dragged into this? And I said, Donald was your sponsor, too. So Al's my sponsor, so you're going to get Al. Because we're sticking together, and I got to go meditate, so you got to go meditate. And Christopher's my friend, my original friend in life, in AA. You know, before that, it was just, you know, associates, you know. And he said, okay. And we went, and we've meditated ever since, from that day to this, every morning. You know, close the eyes, steady the breathing, breathe in, breathe out. You know, it's not about this. It's about coming back to it. Mind wanders, come back. Got a pain in my leg, come back. Right? Wonder what's for dinner, come back. Just keep coming back, man. Just keep coming back. Meditation works. Right? And it's powerful. One of the most powerful, underutilized aspects of the steps, in my personal opinion, ever. Right? So I meditate to quiet the mind. Can you imagine me not meditating? That's horrifying. To me, I find that horrifying. I can't imagine what it's like over there. And step 12, it's the third side of the triangle, service, the spiritual. Having had a spiritual experience is the direct result of working these steps. Right? That was the whole point of it, was to be relieved of the obsession of the mind, the greater aspect of my illness. I can practice these principles and carry the message. And I don't have to go to the Bowery. I don't have to drive to New York and go to Towns Hospital, because that's where, you know, Bill was. That's, you know, I don't have to do that. I just have to go to a meeting. There's a tremendous number of alcoholics sitting in meetings who believe that by being in a meeting, they're working a program. Now, I'm not going to argue with them. If you think you're working a program because you go to meetings, good on you. Me personally, I believe that this is the fellowship vital to my recovery. I couldn't get started. I need to be with my people. I need a place to go. I need a place to be a service. I need to see the examples of recovery around me at all times, right? I need the repetition of it. I need that, right? There's scientific evidence today that says going to meetings changes brain chemistry, that working the steps changes brain chemistry. I need changing in my brain chemistry. Now. So I go to meetings, and that's my fellowship. And I work the program as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's my sword and my shield. Those are the things that protect me. My sobriety date is November 6th, 1980. I've been sober for 35 years, and I couldn't stay sober for a day. You are clapping for yourselves. You're clapping for AA because, you know, there's very little, if any, as Earl sees it in there. That is of any value whatsoever. What's of value is the spiritual toolkit that I was given when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I swore on that mountain I'd never love another human being again as long as I lived. And there's no way I'd ever tell you who I am. There's no way you're going to love me. I'm out, man. This loving and being loved thing, it's not for me. And that's not my story today. You know? Alcoholics Anonymous will pick your pocket like a thief in the night. It robbed me of my anger. It robbed me of the great majority of my self-righteousness. It robbed me of the ever-increasing amount of my ability to lie. Oh, I still lie. Anybody else in here still lie? Everybody who doesn't have their hand up is lying right now. You ever lie for no reason? That's weird, isn't it? I'll be standing there and a guy will walk up and say, so what'd you do today, Earl? I'll say, well, I went to the movies. I think, well, what the hell did I say that for? I don't know why I said that. I did not go to the movies. And telling this guy I went to the movies in no way improved my standing with this individual. There was no point in telling that guy I went to the movies. The only thing I've ever been able to come up with is that deep down inside, that old dopamine alcoholic down in there that's resting peacefully in there, right? That guy, I'm afraid that at some point in the future, I'm going to get myself in a real jackpot and I'm going to have to throw out a whopper. And I wouldn't want to be rusty. So every once in a while, I just lob one out there to make sure I can And a great thing to do to, for you, for the normal folk in here, I apologize, but, you know, it is fun to watch you when, you know, with that, you know, we promptly admit, you know, when we're doing stuff we shouldn't be doing. Like, I'll be telling a story to somebody, and I'm exaggerating, and it's just, you know, as with every other word, this thing, the fish is getting bigger, you know, the guy's getting taller, you know what I mean? Oh, it's just growing and growing and growing. And right in the middle of it, I just stop and go, time out. Everything I just said was complete and utter bullshit. I'm going to start over, all right? And here we go. And you look, and the look on the person's face is like, I don't understand what's happening here. What is he saying? I don't know what's I don't know what's happening. It's all right. It's all right. I'm just, you know, a little nuts. We're going to start over. Because who cares? I mean, you know what I mean? What am I defending? Right? I'm not going to give up my peace of mind, you know, for a 45-foot putt instead of a 20-foot putt. You know what I mean? I'm not doing it. You know, it's just not worth it. I'm free. I walk the earth a free man, no longer enslaved by alcohol or drugs. And that's a direct result of my being involved with Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis. If you are new, this goes way past not drinking or using. It's a design for living. There is a big buzz to be caught here. Come on in. Arm yourself with the fellowship. Arm yourself with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? We do four things. We go to regular meetings regularly. We get a sponsor. We work the steps. And then we're of service to someone else. We get out of ourselves and are of service to others. That's pretty much what we do. Right? And come on in. And just, it's like a minefield. Life's a minefield, man. And you get a sponsor to help you navigate that initial part of the minefield, right? Now, if, you know, if your sponsor goes step there and your step's good, you step there and good, step there is good, step there is good, step there, it blows your leg off, get another sponsor. Start over again and just keep going. You'll find your way. Just stay with us. Stay with us. That's all you got to do. And believe me, I know how hard it is in the beginning to just stay here, to just be with us, you know, because we're so filled with shame in the beginning. You know, there's a different, you know, guilt and shame are very different. Guilt is I've caused a problem. Shame is I am the problem. And so many of us come in here and we are the problem. We are the problem. Come, you know, well, welcome to the best show on earth. If you're the problem, you homicidal, suicidal, kind of bouncing back and forth between the two. Welcome. You're in the right place. Right? Can't stop drinking? Welcome. Right? For you people who have returned. Oh, I'm going to have to figure out how to not say a really bad word. Vinoy's giving me the evil eye. If you've come back and people are giving you a hard time about having relapsed, gone out and come back, gone out and come back. Because we tell you keep coming back. If you are, you keep coming back and you're just struggling, right? And you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. And people start to judge you. They start shunning you. Start giving you that look like, oh, isn't it just terrible? That person just can't get it. That person just can't get it. Just tell them, look, I met this guy, Earl. And he said, you need to go screw yourself. We don't do that. That is not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to extend the hand, not to place judgment upon the person we extend it to or have stopped extending it to. We extend the hand, right? I mean, we had a guy in a meeting for years. We'd pass the basket, and he'd take a couple bucks out every meeting, pass the basket. I remember the first meeting I was in, that basket was coming around. I thought, oh, my God, they're passing a basket. Just don't take the money. Don't take the money. Don't take the money. And I couldn't get that basket by me fast enough, man. Because I knew if I just hovered, man, it'd dip, you know. So I see a guy taking money out. I'm going, I get it. I get it, right? You're going to have an interesting ninth step, buddy. right? And we're going to look forward to it. Just keep coming back. So, you know, and, you know, I want to say, since I've been in this town, you've been so kind to me. Everybody's been wonderful to me. I want to thank Bobby for picking me up, showing me around, you know, being a great representative of New Orleans for y'all. I think that's the way you say it. I want to thank y'all for everything. I love you. There's nothing you can do about that. Thank you. Peace.